Roughly an hour and a half's drive from Phnom Penh on National Road 1, going southeast along the Mekong River, the road that will eventually take you to the border with Vietnam and onto Saigon, you'll find yourself going through the river town of Nhiec Long. A market town, a small trade town, but an important one given its location on the river. For generations, weary travellers would have needed to wait at the Nhiec Long ferry wharf to get across the 2-kilometer-wide river crossing. Those making the trip now can use the Japanese-funded Tsubasa Bridge, completed in 2015. And when driving across it, I'm sure many tourists might not realize just how convenient this journey is compared to the hours that it might have taken back in the day waiting for the ferry. Now, given its strategic location, overlooking the Mekong as it runs northwest to Phnom Penh, it saw a lot of fighting in the decades that Cambodia spent mired in civil war and conflict. The riverside town saw a lot of the worst parts of the war, even from its earliest days. Many of you listening might have even recognized its name from its depiction in the film The Killing Fields, where parts of the town were turned into a string of craters due to a B-52 mistakenly dropping its payload in August 1973, killing and wounding hundreds of civilians. But even earlier than that, the 2-kilometer-wide span of the Mekong that Nhiec Long sits on was witness to one of the first truly grim sights that would presage the next decades of bloodshed in Cambodia. On the 13th of April, 1970, around 3 weeks after the head of the army, Lon Nol, and a band of supporting government ministers, most notably Sirik Mattak, had staged a coup to remove Prince Sihanouk from power while he was out of the country, one of the many consequences of that action began to be seen. Stood at the riverbank near the ferry wharf, the dust coming off the almost orange dirt road that had been baked by the heat of Cambodia's hottest month, was a French Catholic priest. Watching the surging Mekong one morning, he had noticed a body, a man, lifeless, hands tied, civilian clothes, floating downstream, down toward Vietnam, where the Mekong Delta meets the sea. But much like noticing that first blot of rain on your hand or jacket before the downpour, this priest had only seen the beginning of a floating parade of the dead. The journalist Henry Kam, who had come back to Cambodia to cover the aftermath of the coup against Sihanouk, arrived to Nhiec Long 5 days after the priest had witnessed this. And what he described was this ghastly flow. Even 5 days later, after it had started, when he himself took the ferry, he would see 4 bodies floating by themselves, as well as a group tied together with rattan cord. When Kam encountered the priest, he found out that he had been counting these bodies since the beginning. That on one ferry crossing, he had seen upwards of 100 dead male bodies. He had seen as many as 10 men tied together at once. Altogether, he thought that he'd been able to count more than 1,000 that had floated down the Mekong. We don't know their names. Let us at least know their number, the priest, in tears, had explained to the journalist. Kam recounts in his book, Cambodia, Report from a Stricken Land, that in a cruel irony of the war that was engulfing the country, this priest of, in his words, infinite compassion, he'd found out later that he too had been found dead, his throat slashed, and this was after Nhiec Long had been taken by the Vietnamese communist armies and then retaken by the South Vietnamese armies. This was, as he said, a result of the Vietnam War itself having annexed Cambodia. The bodies that were floating down the river were also Vietnamese. However, they were not fighting on one side of their homeland's civil war or another. If anything, they had escaped the problem which had caused so much suffering in their mother country. Thankful that they had not had to pick between the communists of the north, the communist insurgency in the south, or the non-communist regime that had been propped up for the last 15 years by the Americans. More than 400,000 Vietnamese were living in Cambodia at this time, perhaps half of those in Phnom Penh. The murdered men who had been dumped in the Mekong were from a community of Vietnamese who lived just across from Phnom Penh, on the Isle of Troi Trang Va. As you, my dear long-term listener, well know, the relationship between the Khmer and the Vietnamese has been strained since the two peoples became neighbours hundreds of years prior, particularly once the peoples that could be generally referred to as Vietnamese began settling on land that had been part of what could be called Cambodia, particularly around the Mekong Delta, what is now southern Vietnam. And I'll defer to Henry Kam's notes on this, as he says in the same book I mentioned before, quote, "The Vietnamese responded to understandable Cambodian resentment of their presence with thinly disguised disdain. Unlike the large Chinese minority, which was, by and large, successful in integrating with the Khmers, the Vietnamese made no effort to do so, and it is unlikely that such efforts would have been welcomed." End quote. He goes on to detail the ways this ancient ethnic tension had been eventually codified by the Cambodian state, these kinds of official discrimination that had been put in place by Sihanouk. For example, as a way to encourage Cambodian participation in certain trades and professions, a list of 18 occupations were officially barred to Vietnamese living in Cambodia. However, Kam notes that these rules were lazily enforced, and despite this, the Vietnamese population had seen a measure of protection in Sihanouk's Cambodia. But Sihanouk was gone, in large part due to a Vietnamese problem that had been given shape and impetus to fix by those that removed him from power. Lon Nol and Sirik Mattak had come to power on what was essentially a promise to get rid of those tens of thousands of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese troops that had been encamped in sanctuaries on the Cambodian border. Militarily inferior, they soon found that they were quite impotent to prevent them from using these areas, nor could they hold them back from storming attacks coming from the east under the guise of Sihanouk's National Front. Remaining neutral, but also getting rid of the Vietnamese, didn't seem like it was going to work. In the wake of the coup against Sihanouk, the Vietnam War moved into Cambodian territory, and it was the communist Vietnamese who had made the first moves in order to protect themselves. In just a matter of weeks, they had shown that they were utterly superior to Cambodian government troops, who largely abandoned their positions and retreated. The Lon Nol regime, in a panic, leaned on whatever it could to stem what it saw as a complete wash of Vietnamese communist aggression. The lines were blurred between innocent, regular people and the armies of the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese. The boogeyman that had long lived in the mind of the Khmer had become a frightening reality, at least in the minds of the government. And thus, an unstable, fragile new government, which came to power on a mandate they themselves created to secure the country from the tens of thousands of communist Vietnamese troops occupying the border, quickly devolved into something quite ugly. A curfew had been placed on all the Vietnamese in Phnom Penh, and a massive rally took place at the Olympic Stadium that, aside from containing the usual nationalistic trumpeting, also stirred up fear and hate of the Vietnamese. Broad messaging that the Vietnamese in Cambodia favoured the Viet Cong, that they were enemies, hereditary enemies, always wanting to take Cambodian land, something that Sihanouk had also been known to vocalise from time to time. Indeed, these were the echoes of the very foundations of modern Cambodian nationalism, born in the 1920s and 30s, that they were Khmer and not Vietnamese. But it wasn't just rhetoric anymore in April 1970. As the communist armies advanced, deportations began to take place, and there was arbitrary detention of whole Vietnamese communities. In some instances, which we will discuss in more detail later in the episode, killings also broke out. As David Chandler said in The Tragedy of Cambodian History, it was in this state of panic that these killings, including the massacre of the men from Troi Trang Va, were carried out. As Henry Kam relays, quote, They'd been rounded up one night over the tears and pleading of their wives and mothers, sisters and children, and handed over to the Cambodian Navy. An aged invalid and a man whose daughter was married to a Cambodian were the only men left. Navy craft transported the prisoners down the river to one of the many small islands between the capital and the ferry crossing at Nek Long. End quote. Now, another book I've got here, Wilfred Diack's Road to the Killing Fields, confirms this. Says that residents had recalled a large boat arriving one night on the 10th of April, that they had come from Phnom Penh, that the boat had a large number of people, and that for 5 nights afterwards, they heard shooting. The horrible fate that befell these men was not the first instance of a massacre of Vietnamese in Cambodia since the coup, nor was it the last. And while poorly trained and badly misinformed police or security forces were slaying these innocent citizens, the communist troops only kept extending the areas under their control in an absolutely frantic month after the coup. It also begged the question, as one New York Times article articulated, of what the potential role of the United States would be at this crucial time. As the new Cambodian regime begged for support to fend off this communist onslaught, but it was so clearly caught in a conflict that involved centuries of hate. Would deciding to fully support the new Lon Nol government be part of the US mission of containing communism? Or was it going to be another marriage of convenience to provide cover for the process of getting out of Indochina? And how committed were they to that? Do they simply have to do something to stop Phnom Penh falling to the communists in just a matter of weeks? As we'll find out, there are no easy answers to those questions, and every action, regardless of intent, will have its consequences. G'day everyone, welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia, the Khmer Rouge and the Cambodian Nightmare. I'm your host, Lachlan Peters, and as I'm recording this, it's January 2025, and we are going on 7 years since I started this little project. And here we are, Season 3, the story of the Cambodian Civil War and the rise and the demise of the Khmer Rouge regime. Some might say this is going to be the season, after all, of the context and setup where we can examine what the Pol Pot regime did and why and uncover all of the suffering that occurred during. Now, if you're new to the show and just starting here, that's totally fine. But if you do want to go back and catch up just a little, feel free to check out at least the recaps that are available for Season 1 and 2. In this episode, we're going to look at the fateful year of 1970, following on from when Sihanouk had been removed from power and then having joined forces with the communists to take power back. Cambodia, now under non-royal rule in the shape of a slightly heavy-handed and somewhat inscrutable character named Lon Nol, will look to survive. And in doing so, will rely heavily on the United States and South Vietnam to do so. With Nixon in the White House looking to deliver on his election promise to get out of Vietnam, peace with honor, we will see how some of those entanglements work out in the first months of what will become the Khmer Republic. Before we continue the story and explain how the horrible circumstances of the introduction came to be, I just want to take a tiny amount of time to thank everyone for sticking with the show so long, and an extra special thank you to those who have decided to help out the show via a donation with PayPal or Patreon. At the moment, I'm able to get about $250 per month, which is a huge help keeping the show going. Right now, about a quarter of that is going to two really great Cambodian charities each month, so your support is really doing some important work as well as helping me make the show. Remember, you can always help out by giving a 5-star rating or review wherever you're listening to this, and particularly now in this, you know, important season, it'd be really amazing if you could help out on that front. Remember, you can financially help out the show for as little as $2 per month. Back in the day, I'm sure people would have said that's like a cup of coffee. I'm not sure if that really works anymore. So, you know, I get it. But if a good amount of people that were listening decided they could spare that $2 a month, well, let's just say I could focus much more of my attention here on what has become a really important part of my life to keep working on and make this as good as it can be. So, you know, you do get some extra stuff if you continually support the show on Patreon. There's like a commentary track of the film, The Killing Fields, and more recently an audio essay about how the phrase Year Zero was never actually used by the Khmer Rouge. I pop lots of extra bits up there too, like little video breakdowns of each episode after they come out. And I've recently figured out a way to basically give this to people if they just donate via like a one-time donation via PayPal too. So keep that in mind. If you can spare $2 a month to help me make this show and help some great charities each month as well, thank you so much. And again, thank you to everyone who has helped out so far. Incredibly proud to really receive that support. Okay, with that out of the way, let's return to the story. A story that for this episode will revolve around a lot happening in just a few months. So to frame that, we're going to begin with some words of promise and optimism from Richard Nixon, delivered on April 20th, 1970, basically at the same time that Henry Kam was reporting on the bodies floating down the Mekong.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. Tonight, I am pleased to report that progress in training and equipping South Vietnamese forces has substantially exceeded our original expectations last June. Very significant advances have also been made in pacification. Although we recognize that problems remain, these are encouraging trends. However, I must report with regret that no progress has taken place on the negotiating front. The enemy still demands that we unilaterally and unconditionally withdraw all American forces, that in the process we overthrow the elected government of South Vietnam, and that the United States accept the political settlement that would have the practical consequence of the forcible imposition of a communist government upon the people of South Vietnam. That would mean humiliation and defeat for the United States. This we cannot and will not accept. Let me now turn to the third criteria for troop withdrawals, the level of enemy activity. In several areas since December, that level has substantially increased. In recent months, Hanoi has sent thousands more of their soldiers to launch new offensives in neutral Laos in violation of the Geneva Accords of 1962, to which they were signatories. And south of Laos, almost 40,000 communist troops are now conducting overt aggression against Cambodia, a small neutralist country that the communists have used for years as a base for attack upon South Vietnam in violation of the Geneva Accords of 1954, to which they were also signatories. This follows the consistent pattern of North Vietnamese aggression in Indochina. Men and supplies continue to pour down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and in the past 2 weeks, the communists have stepped up their attacks upon Allied forces in South Vietnam. However, despite this new enemy activity, there has been an overall decline in enemy force levels in South Vietnam since December. We have now reached a point where we can confidently move from a period of cut and try to a longer range program for the replacement of Americans by South Vietnamese troops. I am therefore tonight announcing plans for the withdrawal of an additional 150,000 American troops to be completed during the spring of next year. This will bring a total reduction of 265,500 men in our armed forces in Vietnam below the level that existed when we took office 15 months ago. Now, viewed against the enemy's escalation in Laos and Cambodia, and in view of the stepped-up attacks this month in South Vietnam, this decision clearly involves risks. But I again remind the leaders of North Vietnam that while we are taking these risks for peace, they will be taking grave risks should they attempt to use the occasion to jeopardize the security of our remaining forces in Vietnam by increased military action in Vietnam, in Cambodia, or in Laos. I repeat what I said November 3rd and December 15th. If I conclude that increased enemy action jeopardizes our remaining forces in Vietnam, I shall not hesitate to take strong and effective measures.
Okay, folks, that was what I had cut together of Nixon's address to the nation on the situation in Vietnam. Now, there are a few things there that do a lot of work in setting up what we're going to be talking about in this episode, and I suppose, broadly speaking, some big themes about this era of history. The first thing you would have noticed is the tinge of optimism that the speech delivered. Numbers are good. Things are on track. What's this? 150,000 troops coming home? Think about the average person at home watching. Sounds like good news, right? Sounds like Nixon is delivering on that promise of getting out of the war. But he's making it clear that this depends on a few factors. It's also worth pointing out that the 150,000 number, well, there's some smart messaging there. That number is the optimistic take on what will be pulled out over the course of a year. But that bit is kind of smuggled away. Much more impressive to say 150,000 coming home, rather than we'll be getting home in installments, some number per month if things go well. There is a lot of talk about the peace process and the intransigent communists as well. Now, as you can expect, I'm going to go into the context around this speech in a fair bit of detail, but it's worth mentioning that this speech is made just prior to the acknowledgement of what amounts to a public cry for help from Lon Nol as the Vietnamese communist attacks engulf much of Cambodia, even quite close to Phnom Penh. And many of you listening will know that there will be a response from the Nixon administration. The Americans and the South Vietnamese will take a significant action. And with that action, what is commonly referred to as the Cambodia Campaign, or the invasion of Cambodia, or the incursion, if you're speaking from the White House, this, as well as the secret bombing campaign they had started the year before, well, these actions open up a whole litany of accusations of gross negligence, illegality, immorality, and I'm sure by some measure, war crimes. Now, I'm not exactly sure exactly what opinion you might have, or the opinion you might get from your average person on the street, but let's just say if this average person that had at least heard of Cambodia and could point to it on a map, if they heard that word Cambodia, a solid number of them will probably have associations of something along the lines of America bad, or more specifically, Nixon and or Kissinger bad. So without necessarily wanting to change anyone's opinion on that, or for that matter agree with anyone's opinion either, I'm going to present to you the context in which all of this takes place in. And perhaps more than any other topic in the podcast that we've covered so far, I'm going to leave it up to you to decide on what you feel the best course of action may have been. Because 10 days after Nixon delivered that first speech, he will deliver another, and that one is going to shock a lot of people. And it might lead you to the conclusion that I've shared a few times on this podcast so far that when it comes to Cambodian history in this period, well, there's more than enough blame to go around. Lots of blood on lots of different hands. So I want to set up the background to this first speech a little more, and basically I want you to know who wants what each side is aiming to do, and the reasons why. We're entering a very interesting and frantic period of the Cambodian Civil War, and as you might recall from my conversation with Elizabeth Becker, she doesn't even like using that phrase. She felt that the Cambodian campaign in the American Vietnam War was more appropriate. As it happens, I don't fully agree with her in using that phrase to describe the entire 5 or so years of fighting in its totality, but it goes to show just how people have different angles or views of this whole thing, pretty much from the get-go. Very quickly, some dates. Recall, in March 1970, Sihanouk tried to simmer down the tensions that were resulting in his government because of the tens of thousands of Vietnamese troops on Cambodian territory. They tried to stir up some angst against the communist Vietnamese embassies by inciting some riots from the general Cambodian population in Phnom Penh. That was an attempt to shock the Soviets, the Chinese, and Vietnamese into reducing those troop numbers. Lon Nol also proclaimed a kind of ultimatum for all communist troops to leave the country within 72 hours. That didn't work either. Meanwhile, Sihanouk was in Russia and China to ask directly for some help with this. And this is when Sirik Mattak and Lon Nol pulled off their coup on the 18th of March. As Ben Kiernan said in How Pol Pot Came to Power, quote, "On March 20th, only 2 days after the coup, and before Sihanouk had stated his position, all protagonists in the Vietnam War had moved simultaneously," end quote. Now, the biggest mover and shaker here is certainly the Northern Communist Armies and the NLF. Recall that they are separate but functionally the same, so maybe as a shorthand, I'm just going to say the Vietnamese Communist Armies. Forgive me, everyone, with the sort of military precision there on all these different groups, but especially in the sources here, I mean, all the acronyms can get kind of crazy at this time, so let's just try and simplify it for everyone. These Vietnamese Communist Armies, having used this territory as sanctuary to attack South Vietnam for years, including the stunning Tet Offensive of 1968, not to mention the supply bases and everything else, well, they're now facing the prospect of being attacked from both sides, from the Americans and South Vietnamese in the east, and from the new Lon Nol forces in the west. So this is, you know, this is their strategic aim and need. So we've got the communist Vietnamese primary objective: protect the viability of their armies and supply lines in Cambodia in order to maintain their war effort to take South Vietnam. That is their overriding objective, yeah? To that end, their organizational base for pursuing that war effort, what the Americans called COSVN, was located in Cambodia. It wasn't an actual base, as the Americans had mistaken for some time. Like, they thought it was basically a Pentagon-like building constructed underground and stationary. It wasn't that. But it was in Cambodia, in an area known as the Phishuk, a bit of the map that juts into South Vietnam. You recall that this base was basically the target of the secret Operation Menu bombings. But the point I'm trying to get to is just to establish in your mind, okay, for communist Vietnam, their main objective, Cambodia was and had been a hugely important part of that objective. It was fundamental to their war effort in South Vietnam. And when we discuss just how many troops they had and their actions that they took to protect them, you'll just see how important it was. All right, and now let's look at another one of the protagonists and what they wanted to do: the Americans and South Vietnamese. Now, they might have different long-term goals, but the short-term goals and the means are the same. They, more or less, have a kind of equal and opposite objective to the communist Vietnamese. They want to prevent the communists from having this sanctuary in this neighboring, ostensibly neutral country, so that they can defend their own armies and South Vietnam from the threat that they would pose. It's quite simple for them, and we've seen isolated efforts from the southern Vietnamese and Americans since the mid-1960s to do something about this, whether that be the occasional raid that went over the territorial boundary into Cambodia, or the occasional bombing run that we saw under Johnson, or indeed the aforementioned secret carpet bombing that had been going on since Nixon and Kissinger employed it in March 1969. There is a secondary objective for the Americans, however, and that is that they are looking to simultaneously remove their troops from the conflict, conduct peace talks with the North, and make sure that the South was well enough defended so that the country would not collapse before an agreement could be reached at the negotiation table, or occur in such a dramatic way that they look like they simply abandoned their ally. It's a tough mix to get just right, and it went under the label of Vietnamization of the conflict. In the background, the peace talks that had started under Johnson were continuing in Paris, with Kissinger and Nixon's initial attempts to scare the North Vietnamese not really proving to work with their madman theory of 1969. Also, Kissinger is basically doing secret peace talks with Lê Đức Thọ that are kind of basically the real peace talks, but we'll sort of get into that another time. And the other protagonist here is the Cambodians, newly led by Lon Nol. Their primary objective? Get the communist Vietnamese armies out of the country, as we've said. And force was now seemingly the only available option. The problem was that the majority of the armed forces that Lon Nol had under his command were simply not up to that task, and were being overrun almost immediately by the Vietnamese. And we shouldn't forget the other sort of protagonist in all of this, the Khmer Rouge. Now, their contributions and reactions in all of this will be the primary focus of the next episode, but for now it's worth saying what their aims are, taking power in Cambodia. However, with the caveat of in these early days, they didn't have the military or administrative capability to do that. So they're very much going to be under the wing and supporting the Vietnamese communists. And they're going to train them up in a number of ways. And as you can imagine, there's this angst and, you know, a number of ruffled feathers for the Khmer Rouge leaders at having to have that scenario be what's going on. But as I said, we'll sort of focus on them in the next episode. Alright, so we obviously have some competing interests here, and this is going to play out on Cambodian territory, and especially for the next year or so, will basically just look like the war in Vietnam having literally spilled over the territorial boundary. This will necessitate the Lon Nol government to seek massive amounts of help to repel that invasion, and that will come from the United States and South Vietnam. So in that sense, yes, this year in particular very much is the Vietnam War being fought in Cambodia, especially as early clashes involved Vietnamese units fighting Vietnamese units in many cases. I think the fighting does look more like something you'd call the Cambodian Civil War later once the Khmer Rouge take up the majority of the fighting on their side. But as I said, that happens more after about 1972. Until this point, the Vietnamese communists have, more or less, had a kind of blanket that had been securing their activities in Cambodia, this kind of open secret afforded by their collusion with Sihanouk. But that blanket has been torn off since the coup. Their ticket to remain in the country was no longer valid. But they were going to expand their presence and fight to maintain their forces in the country. Cleverly, they were going to do so with a slight attempt to veil this under the efforts of the new National Front that Sihanouk was ostensibly the head of, which will end up just being the Khmer Rouge. But for the moment, pretty much the communists, the Vietnamese communists, I should say, are doing all of the fighting, as there were only around 3,000 to 5,000 Khmer Rouge guerrillas. Now, I've gone over all of this just to give you the context, yes, but also for you to be able to make up your own mind about a few commonly held beliefs about this era of history. Take, for example, the book by William Shawcross, Sideshow. Fantastic book, a lot of great work in that, very useful, really gets into the choices that are made by the Americans and does a great job of highlighting how they were, in his opinion, poorly made choices. It is the definitive book on the subject, but that also may have to do with it perhaps being the only one that has gone into such focus and detail, and that's obviously worth a lot in and of itself. But that title is so good that it's almost taken up a lot of the mental space for talking about this whole topic. Basically, the idea that Cambodia was just a sideshow for Nixon and Kissinger. Now, how accurate is that? Well, to a large extent, I suppose it works very well. Cambodia was of less importance to the Americans as South Vietnam and their objectives there. However, let's not lose the plot completely. Is Cambodia a sideshow to the Vietnam War? I suppose, but I suppose it depends on what you think about sideshows. Like, this is a very important one. This is, metaphorically, necessary viewing to, you know, get the movie. Did Kissinger and Nixon think it was a sideshow? I think they saw it as an important factor in their overall aims, but these were aims that put the USA first, not the Cambodian people, not the Vietnamese people. Did they care about Cambodia? No, I don't think they particularly did. But, just like the communist Vietnamese, who also didn't care that much about Cambodia, as long as they were able to continue doing what they needed to do to suit their needs, Nixon and Kissinger are the same. And the same goes for the calls of illegality or ethics or this moral issue with the violation of Cambodian sovereignty. You will really only hear this levelled at Nixon and Kissinger, but the same moral compass is seldom applied to the North Vietnamese in basically unilaterally deciding to make use of Cambodian territory for their war aims in the South. Like, there is a slight double standard there. The same goes for the bombing. If there were no Vietnamese troops in Cambodia, America wouldn't have bombed the country. This wasn't unprovoked, just like the invasion will not be done just for the hell of it. And to that extent, it isn't a sideshow at all. Cambodia was a fundamentally important part of the conflict, for both sides. The communists absolutely had relied on what they were doing there for years, and the Americans and South Vietnamese wanted to stop that happening, especially now that it seemed like it could be the case that the whole country could be now lost to the communists. So then instead of them just having some sanctuaries on the border, they'd have an entire country as a staging ground for attacks on South Vietnam. From the perspective of Saigon, that would be the whole western flank of the country as this vulnerable area. And in a context where the Americans are trying to get their own troops out, well, it's not a scenario conducive to having the whole western flank vulnerable. I guess the most fundamental aspect of the Vietnam War is that for the Vietnamese, this war was everything. For the North, for the Viet Cong, it was beyond their top priority, to the extent that they endured total war conditions for many years to continue fighting it. And this was a point made in David Halberstam's Best and Brightest, where he makes the point like, sure, you've got the world's superpower, the USA, the super military, 200 million or so people up against a little country in Asia with something like 30 million people. But for the Americans, the Vietnam War is never going to be the top priority, is it? It was never even the top priority of one administration since Eisenhower. Although you could maybe say it was a top priority for Nixon to do something about getting out of the war. I mean, in that same speech that I played parts of before from Nixon, a little bit later in it, he references the astronauts on Apollo 13 getting back to Earth. And that just gives you some perspective about what else was drawing attention. So I don't want to get too lost down this path, but when we discuss what happens across April, May, and June, I don't think casually referring to what happens there as a sideshow makes much sense unless you kind of incorporate just how significant a problem the Cambodian sideshow represented. And like I said, that's both for the Americans, the South Vietnamese, and the Communist Vietnamese. How much any of them truly cared about Cambodia and its future, divorced of their own aims and interests, I'm not too sure. The same thing happened in the 50s, when the leaders of the Indochinese Communist Party created the Cambodian equivalent, because it was to serve their interests in the war with the French, the Vietnamese interests, not for some benevolent gift to the Cambodian people. From our vantage point, with knowledge of what happened, of course it's hard not to look back and just call the whole thing pointless and terrible. Few wars aren't. But like most history, it's rarely as simple or one-sided as it might seem on the surface. Okay, and apologies for not going through this in just the strict kind of linear this happened and then this happened and then this happened kind of way, but that's what this show is. And now that you've got the background, the reasons that all of this stuff is going to happen, well, maybe we can do a little bit of this happened and this happened stuff. So recall where we were leaving this all off. Basically, Lon Nol has said to the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, you guys have to go. And then they didn't. And then his government even had some actual state meetings, like between representatives and leaders with the NLF and the North Vietnamese. And he said, you guys all have to go. And they said, no. There was actually a communist Vietnamese document captured from Cosvin around this time that basically said, if negotiations do occur and if they fail, meaning that if Lon Nol does not let them do what Sihanouk had been letting them do, then they would invade and provide a program to bring the Khmer communists to power. So here we are. Really interestingly, and I hadn't seen this before reading General Sakhan's Reflections on the War, a book that has been republished in a very nice way by Mekong River Press and friend of the show Matt Madden, by the way. I'll leave a link to that in the show notes. But the general also makes this point that before the war really began, so with the appeal of Sihanouk, the riots subsequent to that, the chaos in some places between government troops and these Sihanouk supporters, he says that these were really made in a way that kind of made it look like what was going to happen next was a civil war. These are Cambodians who didn't like the new government and they're fighting to take it back. No one from the outside needs to be involved, right? That's generally what that would look like to the outside world. Now, that's interesting because I'd always seen these outbursts as a kind of natural result of Sihanouk's overthrow and his appeal to his children, as he called them. But I can also see from this sort of other perspective that these riots that took place also played into this wider strategy of making the coming Vietnamese invasion seem like it wasn't exactly that. It kind of muddies the waters and makes it kind of hard to see who's who, and it makes the new Cambodian government look bad and unpopular and like the people are simply rising up. And remember, when we discussed these demonstrations, these riots, they were deadly, you know, and they were put down by the government with little remorse as well. So if we consider the general's view on them, I guess from their point of view, because they were occurring in areas that were adjacent to communist Vietnamese activity, they felt that these were much more orchestrated than just the locals banding together of their own accord, having heard Sihanouk's appeal on the radio or wherever else they might have seen it. And this might explain some of their wider suspicions with the Vietnamese population. So March 18th, that's the coup, and in just a few weeks there are more than four divisions of the North Vietnamese Army and Viet Cong operating in the area south and southeast of Phnom Penh. In the north and east of the country, in their sanctuaries they've held for some time, the same areas that the Khmer Rouge themselves had been operating in against Sihanouk, and you also have a significant presence operating north and northwest of the Tonle Sap. That's the area near Siem Reap. Now, many of those armed forces, as we've been at pains to explain, were already in the country, but this is, I don't know, I kind of get a visual equivalent of sort of poking an ant's nest, and it's just all of a sudden you've got all of this activity and it's spread out everywhere. And due to the militarily heavy nature of some of the research I was doing, I finally did, you know, look up what some of these words mean, embarrassingly for me. So a division is upward of about 10,000 troops. So that's one division. So at least 40,000 communist Vietnamese troops operating in Cambodia, perhaps up to 60,000. And the new Lon Nol regime has less than 35,000 troops under their command. And as we'll see, they're barely equipped and not a match for their battle-hardened opponents. One great example to get at this is when you look at how the army had been supplied for the last couple of decades. Remember, it was a half-assed effort by the French at the end of the war. Then it was the United States for a little bit when Sihanouk was getting a third of his economy paid for by them. And then in the 1960s, when he shunned that, it began to be supplied by the Soviet countries. So you've got old French guns, old American guns, and then the ones the communists use. Now imagine the gaps in training and expertise you might have between these systems. Not to mention what would happen if something needed repair or spare parts, or the difference between the ammunition that would be used. As General Sak Sutsa Khan points out, having all this mixed up equipment causes no end of problems. The other factor here is that once they declared themselves in power, the Lon Nol government did embark on this massive recruitment drive, capitalizing on the energy in Phnom Penh in particular, where dissatisfaction with Sihanouk had been greatest. And they get huge numbers of young men volunteering, with nothing much to equip them with. And by the thousands, they threw themselves into this conflict in an almost casual manner. Much like the Lon Nol regime had essentially declared war on a much more powerful enemy without much preparation. Chandler speaks of this in Tragedy of Cambodian History, quote, "Thousands of young people were let out of school to demonstrate against the prince and the Viet Cong. Dressed in khaki, in military formations, believing they could drive the Vietnamese away with their righteousness and determination, every day they could be seen setting out from the city, hanging on to the sides of Coca-Cola trucks or brightly painted buses, wearing shower clogs or sandals, shorts or blue jeans, part of old French uniforms or oversized American fatigues, some empty-handed, some carrying French, Russian, East German, American, Chinese weapons, laughing as they headed for the war. Between April and June 1970, thousands of these volunteers were killed in battles near the capital. Battle-hardened after a quarter of a century of warfare, the Vietnamese found them easy targets." End quote. The Cambodian army, compared to the North Vietnamese or Viet Cong, well, it's like comparing a car that has been built out of different parts at a junkyard to, I don't know, a relatively new Hyundai. Still under warranty, functional, doesn't break down, does what it's supposed to, and you can rely on it. It's not just numbers, it's quality and speed. Between the 3rd of April and the 24th of April, so starting 2 weeks after the coup, there were at least 29 major communist attacks in Cambodia's 8 south and central eastern provinces. 29 major attacks. It's like a blitzkrieg. I'll quote General Sak Sutsa Khan's military history again here. Quote, "Following this stage play," and he's referring to the outcomes of the Sihanouk appeal and the riots and things like that that we talked about. "Following this stage play, the NVA/VC suddenly began on the 29th of March 1970 to exert their overt aggression against Cambodia. It was a very sudden and widespread attack conducted along the eastern and southeastern boundaries and coming from the sanctuary areas. The suddenness of these attacks did not cause much of a surprise to the FANK." And I'll stop there for a second too. Look, if you're around these sources and you're sort of aware of the different parties here, you'll know there are a lot of acronyms for the different sort of military parts of all of these various operations and governments and revolutionary governments and things like that. So FANK, FANK, that is the Lon Nol Government Army, or technically the Khmer National Armed Forces, not to be confused with, say, the GRUNC, which is the national front that Sihanouk was nominally at the head of, with the Khmer Rouge and the Chinese and the Vietnamese and everything like that. So, look, I don't have a lot of love for all of these acronyms, particularly when they pertain to just the military here or there, or like the air force of one of these protagonists or not. So I'm actually going to kind of steer clear of these acronyms, even if I am quoting them, because I can find them a little bit hard to keep track of. And for you, a listening audience as well, I think that might muddy the waters too. So let's get back to the quote, but just bear that in mind for me, please. "The suddenness of these attacks did not cause much surprise because we had expected them all along, but the time available for defense operations was so short, just 2 days, that many isolated and weakly manned outposts succumbed under the violence of the first enemy assaults. From these very first days, therefore, the Lon Nol government troops were driven back by the enemy push. In rapid succession, the following towns and cities fell into enemy hands. I'm going to end the quote there, because afterwards he just lists 10 different towns and cities, and when you look at them on a map of Cambodia, it's basically punched out locations on all of the major roads and the provincial capitals, as far up as Siem Reap in the northwest, Stung Treng, Ratanakari in the north and northeast, plenty to the east of Phnom Penh like Kompong Cham, Kratcher, even south like Takeo and Kampot. Almost like this crescent shape that takes up everything except Phnom Penh, and to the west, almost up towards Battambang. So you've got the capital basically surrounded on three sides by enemy forces. This is the first few weeks of this war, of the post-coup Cambodia. So the Lon Nol forces are retreating, abandoning outposts in places like the Parrot's Beak in the Fishhook, the part of the territory jutting into South Vietnam. Highways are being cut, and that's huge. You'll notice Cambodia has this very straightforward, like, National Road 1, 2, 3, through to 8. And that's basically just connecting Phnom Penh to and from all the provincial capitals. Then you've got these double-digit routes, but, you know, for simplicity, let's just say these big national roads, like 1, 2, 3, 4. These are essential. By April 20th, Route 2 was cut between the capital and the southern province of Takeo on April 23rd. Then Route 1, linking Phnom Penh and Svai Rieng, was severed. The country's northeastern provinces of Kratcher, Mondulkiri, Ratanakiri, and Stung Treng, they're under enemy control like that. So, not just being fought over, they are now isolated from the government and in enemy hands. This is like watching the lights go out on a power grid. Boom, boom, boom. And once they're out and the road is cut, very difficult to do much to get that light back on. Get that, you know, metaphorical electricity flowing again. And what is so stunning about this is just how close it is to Phnom Penh in next to no time. And that's why I wanted to talk about one of these battles in a bit more detail to give sort of a sense of what this war looked like from its earliest days. If we look at what journalists in the country were reporting, someone like Henry Kam, which he would expand on in his later book, which we've quoted a few times so far, we can get a glimpse into what this looked like from the ground level. So he describes a Sunday afternoon in mid-April, but I believe it would have been around the 20th. So just a few weeks after the Vietnamese communist offensive had begun, and the same day Nixon's optimistic address to the nation was made that we heard earlier. It was a force of about 100 communist Vietnamese that had seized a market town that is just about 25 kilometers away from Phnom Penh, or 15 miles, just south on the Besak River, a little place called Sang. Now, Kam says that on the way to the town the next morning, it was as if the population in Phnom Penh knew nothing about how close a war zone was. Similarly, when there were two roadblocks on the way, they were unmanned. People still worked in the fields along the way, and a policeman at the third checkpoint out on this highway, when he asked him if he was going in the right direction to get to Sang, well, this guy cheerfully waved him through with no warning that he was going into a war zone. Now, Kam did mention that there were taxis coming from the direction that he was going. And they were stacked high with people and belongings, most probably fleeing from the districts to Phnom Penh. I'll quote him directly as he arrives to the area in question. The combat zone began at Khao Khor, 3 miles from Sang. It was marked by lines of antiquated buses and trucks. They were parked on both sides of the road that follows the bends of the Besak. Pepsi-Cola signs shone luridly on the flanks of the trucks. The motley motor pool was the dirt-poor Cambodian army's hastily commandeered troop transport, an equivalent of the taxis that rushed the defenders of Paris to the Marne in World War I. Cautiously, their drivers had parked them pointing back toward Phnom Penh. Hardly a sign of confidence. End quote. Kham's description of these events has a certain tragicomic tone. First of all, there is the absolutely wild notion of the war being, you know, this close to Phnom Penh, you know, half an hour's drive down the road. So for it all to have this air of casualness is an interesting setting. But it goes further. Like at the farmhouse that the colonel who is going to command the attack to repel these communists in Sang, you know, where he set up his little base, where the owner of the farmhouse and his wife are still pottering about, and it was just all a little unremarkable. The journalist mentioned that the two little daughters of the farmer were more than happy to get a push on the swing for a while. It's something that if you saw it in a movie, you'd say, well, this is very good satire, isn't it? But overall, in reality, there's a lack of seriousness to it all. But then it gets to the actual attack. So more than 1,000 Cambodian government troops have been amassed. By mid-morning, two planes with machine guns swoop three times over the center of the town, guns blazing. The center of the town was less than a half a mile away. The Vietnamese troops respond with automatic weapons. Now I'll quote what Cam said happened next. Meanwhile, Dien Del, that's the commander sort of making this whole operation happen, Dien Del had difficulty communicating with the pilots to direct their action, because his radio and theirs were old and faulty. He also lacked a map of the region. But after sending a message to the geographic service in Phnom Penh, requesting a set of detailed maps of the area, they arrived in short order. All but the needed map. A second messenger was then dispatched but didn't return. It was time for Colonel Dien Del and his men to lunch. The farmer and his wife retired to the shade beneath their house on stilts for a nap. April is Cambodia's hottest month. End quote. So, you know, you're the colonel, you're trying to get things done, you need a map, you can't get a map, a guy goes to get a map, brings back the maps, not the right map. Mondays, eh? Nothing's going right. It was set to continue because lunch gets interrupted by a Vietnamese barrage of rockets, mortars and rifles. And some of the, you know, the hodgepodge arrangement of trucks and buses that had been used to get all the troops down to Sang are hit by this. Kham then says that just as soon as that fire broke out, it stopped. That no real damage had been done, but that the Cambodian counterattack, well, that's going to have to be put off for a day. Tuesday turned out to be a much sadder performance. Kham states that Cambodian officers told journalists that the operation would employ psychological warfare. Dozens of Vietnamese men, women and young girls, plucked from nearby internment, were lined up across the road and made to walk from the ends of the government-claimed area into the communist-controlled part of the town. They were given white flags and bullhorns, told to yell out for the communist troops to withdraw. A handful of government troops followed closely behind. Then, when a single communist soldier rose from cover and waved the oncoming Vietnamese civilians away, and one of the government troops raised his rifle and fired, well, then the communists returned fire as well. And as Kham states, quote, the captive psychological warriors were caught in between. About 10 were dragged away wounded. It isn't known how many lost their lives in this cruelly harebrained sacrifice of the innocent. On that Tuesday, the liberation of Sang was postponed once more. Psychological warfare had failed. End quote. So again, here we have the same kind of violence being used against Vietnamese civilians and not far from where they were still floating down the Mekong, where they had been killed prior. This effort by the FANC, the government troops, to repel these invaders, well, it had the subtlety and nous of a 10-year-old trying to make a souffle. On the Wednesday, a government report stated that around 50 Cambodian troops had been killed or wounded in fighting around Sang. So, it seems that at least that day, the battle to take it back proceeded beyond forcing civilians with white flags to ask the communists to go away. But it was the next day, the Thursday, that the battle ended. But this wasn't exactly a win either. By Thursday afternoon, after an artillery and mortar barrage on the center of the town, smashing everything up, the government troops slowly proceeded in, confident that nothing serious could still be there to confront them after such a hammer blow. Once they arrive, they're told by some locals who had remained that the communists had left that morning, before dawn. For 5 days, these 100 invaders had camped out and repelled a force much larger than theirs, a stone's throw from the nation's capital. It was a damning indictment of what the government army could produce, what they were capable of, but more importantly, it showed that the communists would be able to carry out a war strategy that they had perfected over years in Vietnam. They would be able to attack all across the country. They were highly mobile, battle-hardened. And I realize men against boys is a well-used cliche, but at times this will literally be men against boys. And then in a few years, when it's just Khmers fighting Khmers, well, sometimes it's going to be boys against boys. So I hope that what happened at Sung kind of gives you a window into this. Don't get me wrong, this isn't the whole war is like this, or had been like this, but this particular example does have a lot to show you. And recall that this is still just in the first month of the war. There are a few things that are going on in the background that really put the pressure on. And I just want to touch on those briefly before we move on to what happens next. The first thing we have to readdress is the treatment of the Vietnamese, and that's a terrible understatement. What we are talking about was widely reported on, it was corroborated, it was, as many writers have described it, a pogrom against the civilian Vietnamese population. So what happened in Sang was one example, what happened to those from Troi Trung Va was another, but it was even earlier when the first story came out, or should I say the first story that was able to be covered came out, from near the town of Prasat in the Parrot's Beak area close to Vietnam. The local Vietnamese communities there were sort of brought to internment camps and were told that there was going to be an imminent Viet Cong attack. And they were told to flee. Afterwards, the Cambodian soldiers simply shot them as they ran. The government said that they had been killed in crossfire. Elsewhere, there were reports of more than 3,000 people, males over the age of 15 usually, who were rounded up and shot in the Vietnamese suburbs north of Phnom Penh. Many of the women who were left behind faced sexual assault. In Takeo, around the same time, those Vietnamese that had been holed up in a school were also mercilessly gunned down. A reporter from the London Observer, Mark Frankland, said that, quote, "It looked and smelled like a slaughterhouse. The cement floor was covered with pools of coagulated blood. About 40 Vietnamese men and boys lay on the far side of the classroom. It was difficult to see how many wounded. One man had stuffed clothes into an open stomach wound. The inside of the classroom's single wall was peppered with bullet holes, but not the outside." End quote. So this is for the month or so that this sort of thing goes on in 1970, I mean, we don't need to get into the whole argument about definitions, crimes, and the legalistic side of that, but from what I know, I don't think it's that far off what would be considered ethnic cleansing, potentially even genocide, given that the pronouncements from the Lon Nol government around this time about the Vietnamese could constitute intent, and that they discussed the victim group on the basis of their nationality. So this really can't be ignored in how terrible it was. And I think David Chandler summed it up very well when he wrote in Tragedy of Cambodian History, quote, At best, the killing showed that Lon Nol was unable to control the violence of his subordinates. At worst, they revealed that Lon Nol and his associates were willing to conduct a racially based religious war against unarmed civilians whose families had lived in Cambodia for generations. End quote. Henry Kam captures the mood of at least some of the Cambodians themselves. He was around during this time in Phnom Penh. Quote, as the certainty of widespread atrocities grew, so did the silence of the regime and the ostentatious indifference of private Cambodians, even open-minded, French-educated members of the elite. The responses of friends and acquaintances were little different from those of officials. You foreigners don't understand the historical context. The Vietnamese have for centuries done unspeakable things to Cambodians and would do worse if today they were in the Cambodians' position. Believe us, we know that the Vietnamese here have long been thoroughly infiltrated by Viet Cong agents. We have to defend ourselves. End quote. It was a terrible situation for those people to be in. And if we're looking at it from a different angle, it's also a terrible situation for the Lon Nol regime to put itself in. If you'll recall, my dear listener, the ethnic tension here is not new. It was not invented by Lon Nol or his regime, but perhaps simply used, like an awful resource that was simmering beneath the ground for centuries. It's that kind of energy that was unleashed. But asking why involves exactly what we had been discussing in the last episodes of Season 2, and confronting the very difficult situation that the Lon Nol government was now in. And I'm not attempting to both sides this at all, but the reality is that they were facing an invasion from the North Vietnamese and National Liberation Front armies into Cambodia. And we just saw how far into Cambodia. They're right near Phnom Penh. They were right in the thick of a war, and they were not doing well. Chandler suggests a kind of panic on behalf of the military and police, as well as those giving out orders. It seems they reached for the lowest possible lever to pull when they were scared: ethnic hatred and violence. Eventually, the killings were halted by outside pressure. Particularly galling was that the South Vietnamese were Lon Nol's new ally, and were going to be dependent on to fight in Cambodia. And we will see how that will work out in a moment, but you can imagine just how badly that looks. Particularly as when questioned about these massacres, Lon Nol had explained away these killings by stating that there was a difficulty in determining whether these Vietnamese they were killing were Viet Cong or peaceful citizens. It speaks to this really bizarre atmosphere. Chandler mentioned Lon Nol's racially based religious war, and that is really how it is being framed by him in this sort of very subjective view of things from the top of the new regime. He'll discuss the Vietnamese communists in terms of unbelievers and brings a very odd racial view of the Mon Khmer as this superior race that would be invincible with their Buddhist values. As if the ethnic hatred wasn't enough, he was imbuing it with religious differences as well. There's this unreality to the situation. It comes to the fore again during the Pol Pot regime as well. But at this time, within this month, where the new Cambodian government has lost so much territory to this invasion, where there are attacks on a village just 15 miles away from Phnom Penh, when the best military tactic they have employed so far has been simply to retreat and abandon their outposts in those areas close to the borders. But as Kam said, if you're walking around the capital city, things didn't seem all that dire. In fact, there was almost a feeling of excitement. With Sihanouk gone, many young people had been encouraged to come out of school to protest him. Many more very young volunteers would be spurred on by this, and as Chandler says, there was a potent mix of nationalism and dreams of economic gain, with the prospect of aid from the United States sitting just on the horizon. It's a tough thing to wrap your head around in these earliest parts of the war, but what was happening to Cambodia at this time? I mean, we've discussed how much the small, untrained, minor incursions that the Khmer Rouge had been making since they declared war in 1968, but just in a few weeks, The government in Phnom Penh has retreated from all those areas they were contesting and has seen whole provinces going dark. And as we said, it wasn't just in the east, it's sort of south and southwest of Phnom Penh and in the north as well. So it's kind of hard to imagine for us, I suppose, with, I guess, how modernized everything has become. We feel very connected to much of the world most of the time, let alone to our communities and different parts of our countries. But just imagine for a second. I mean, perhaps similar to how you might have experienced the COVID pandemic, I can speak for the experience in Australia where we had weeks and months where whole states were just closed to one another. You just couldn't go where you used to. Now, of course, we could still call people and send parcels and things like that, but in Cambodia in 1970, you had places just going out overnight. Provinces just went out of bounds. Or as Calm highlights, this, you know, he'll sort of go to the central post office and he sees this, in his words, sad handwritten list of provinces and towns that mail could still be delivered to, and that was getting shorter day by day. He recalled thinking that the seeming ease at which Phnom Penh kept running may have been due to some background moves by the Lon Nol government to keep everything sort of going smoothly while keeping secret just how bad things were getting. And that would make sense, you know, you don't want to panic everyone, so you sort of keep things, on a need-to-know basis. But then he realized that actually the leaders themselves really didn't know much of what was happening outside the capital. Lon Nol was ignorant of the situation he was facing. And Calm himself found this out via someone we've not talked about for a long time in this series. His little brother, Lon Non, the former classmate of Salat Sar during their time in high school together in Kampong Cham in the 1940s. Someone who went down a quite different, but not totally unrelated path. Lon Non is someone that we really have to keep an eye on for the next part of the series because he will go from a fairly innocuous bit of nepotism as the unimpressive appointment to the head of military police, and he transforms basically, well, into the reality of really bad nepotism as the megalomaniacal head of military police. But in 1970, when Henry Calm was speaking to him, he was still this kind of unsure guy, still feeling out the role and the position. And the journalist wrote in Report from a Stricken Land that it seemed simply by the dint of him knowing French, unlike many other Western journalists rushing to cover this new front in the war, he became privy through Lon Non to many of the plans, actions, and his state of mind, as well as of the new Prime Minister, Lon Nol, who was, quote, at that critical time, remarkably ignorant of the state of the military action in his country, end quote. We'll see more of how that works in a moment, but I also wanted to touch on something that's quite related to this, and it's what Cam states is a basic fact of what was happening at this time, which was his contention that journalists were actually performing a very important intelligence gathering service for the government just by going out into the countryside and reporting on the war, but it was extremely dangerous. It was in early April, as the war engulfed much of Cambodia's eastern provinces, that this became starkly apparent. Over a four-year period, eight news seekers disappeared in Svai Riang. One of them was Sean Flynn, the son of the movie star Errol Flynn. This story is relayed in a few different places, but I think Henry Calm's is good because he was literally there and saw them the day that they disappeared. And I'll just sort of briefly go over the story, but basically a bunch of journalists had been told about the liberation of a small town called Chipu. There was a military convoy going there, and they were told that they could go along to cover the story as well, but the convoy was quite slow, so the journalists end up getting to the town ahead of the military. There, they find out from locals that the town hadn't been liberated, that the Vietnamese troops that had set fire to the small military outpost that had been there since the French years, well, the Viet Cong basically just left of their own accord after doing that. So Calm is getting a drink in town when Sean Flynn and his friend Dana Stone turned up on their motorbikes and said that they had approached but not been let through a Viet Cong roadblock beyond the town. They said that they were going to give it another try, though. Kam says that they were wearing items of American military camouflage, and they warned them to not get too close to the Viet Cong. But the two young guys laughed it off. A little later, they waved as they drove their motorcycles past them, and it was the last time they were seen by Westerners again. Wilfred Diak states that they were stopped by soldiers of the North Vietnamese 9th Division, and then taken prisoner. They were moved about to foil rescue attempts, but eventually the two were handed over to the Cambodian communists, who executed them in June 1971 in Kampong Cham province, far from where they were originally captured the year before. Now, their remains have never been positively identified. They numbered among 20 journalists or photographers who disappeared in the earliest moments of the war in Cambodia. That rivaled the number of those who had been killed in the last 6 years of war in Vietnam. So in just 1 month. And why was that? Well, it was a different story to Vietnam. You weren't going along as much with the military. Kam explains his operations and gives you an insight where most mornings he gets in a rented car and just goes out on the roads, linking the capital to the countryside, basically going on and on until he found a village that was empty, or when the paddy fields weren't being worked on, sort of getting clues and finding out when he went back that these areas had become unsafe and that there were Viet Cong further beyond. Sort of learning how to read the scene a little bit. Again, this sort of speaks to the lack of management of everything that was going on, and especially in this early period. Recall that in the first few weeks, the new government, which had overthrown Sihanouk, was still trying to maintain a kind of neutrality on the international scene that, however long it had been abused, had been the status quo for the last decade or so. So this really wasn't an American war at this point, and I hope you're getting a sense of how poorly prepared to do war the Cambodians were. They were throwing inexperienced teenagers, teachers, anyone else that was willing to be signed up or coerced into signing up, into a fight with one malfunctioning gun to share between five men, or sometimes no gun. I remember seeing one instance of fighting where the Cambodian troops complained of only being armed with grenades. With various provincial capitals being lost to the communist invasion, with fighting occurring at Sang and lasting for almost a week, the mood becomes quite dire for Lon Nol and those highly placed in the new regime. So, on the 21st of April, almost exactly a month after the coup, Lon Nol sent an urgent appeal to Nixon, requesting help for Cambodia in this critical situation. The New York Times reports it as such, quote, "The Cambodian appeal was sent to the United States Embassy for forwarding. It was the first appeal of so urgent a tone and on such a high level made by Cambodia since the crisis that the government says has been provoked by the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong invaders." End quote. The next edition continues the story and tone, quote, "An atmosphere of heightening national emergency is overtaking Cambodia. It is due to evidence that the Cambodian army is unable to turn back the Vietnamese communist forces and to the limited response to Premier Lon Nol's appeal to all nations for arms aid. The discouragement over the failure of such countries as the United States and France, on which Cambodia had counted for important aid, reached a point this evening where the official military spokesman, Major Am Rong, appealed to foreign newsmen at his briefing to awaken world public opinion to Cambodia's pressing need for arms, ammunition, and other equipment. Major Am Rong declined to say how long the army could hold out with what they had." End quote. Now, those news articles show you how this story developed from the outside perspective from day to day. And you could imagine something similar happening today, you know, a crisis somewhere, and there is this expectation that the United States will do something. The Cambodian government is now openly calling for assistance, and their parliament is even looking to get ahead of arguments against their call for assistance that they think are going to come up. So they're already saying things in this joint letter from the Cambodian parliament saying, "We wouldn't consider this to be interfering in our internal affairs. This is assistance to a country in danger. and I'll quote them here. This is from the Senate President and President of the National Assembly in Cambodia. We can assure you, moreover, that Cambodia would have preferred that the great international organizations assure her the peace and the security to which she is entitled. But, attacked and invaded, we have no other choice but to defend ourselves, with the material help of countries that affirm their devotion to liberty and justice, or alone with our poor means in a world indifferent to the destruction of a nation. End quote. So, they're throwing in a little bit of guilt in there. And it's interesting, isn't it? Sort of trying to get ahead of the arguments that US government officials might be raising about this Cambodia situation. Essentially, this idea of spreading the war when they're supposed to be reducing it and saying, hey, look, the Cambodians are saying, we need help. Aren't you guys all about defending liberty? There's almost some reverse psychology in there, like, oh, poor us, I thought America cared about poor countries getting taken over by communists, so I guess not. The next day, the 25th of April, the reporting builds. The spokesmen of Washington and Moscow rival each other on what's happening in Cambodia. Is it a foreign invasion or a fratricidal civil war? It also begs the question of exactly what Nixon might do, with different parts of the military or CIA giving slightly different forecasts. It certainly is a pickle. What would you do? Do you just try and save what's there? Is the threat that the communists are going to topple the regime or just re-secure their sanctuaries on the border? Are we going to risk international and domestic opinion by seemingly opening up a new front in the war? But what about South Vietnam's defences while you try and get troops out? Is the Lon Nol regime stable? Should we keep it stable? What about the killings of Vietnamese civilians? But can we let the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese take control of this development in the war? Can we sit idly by? A lot of questions, and the clock is ticking.